Back at Melford Cross, Paul found Charlie Vosper at his field headquarters in the drill hall, sticking pins in a map of the district and biting into a bacon sandwich.
"What do you want?" he snapped.
"Thought you might be lonely out here among the natives. Talk to Ronnie yet?"
"Hobden, the local bobby's got a low opinion of him, but he doesn't understand crime. He thinks it was Ronnie's fault that his father quarrelled with Mortimer."
Paul nodded.
"But would Ronnie murder his dad?"
"That depends. He seems a bit impetuous and spoiled, to put it mildly. He was arrested for drunkenness over in Boston, but he got off. Not much else."
A uniformed constable came hurrying over to the desk.
"Sir, they found a note from Mr. Kelby."
"Saying?" Vosper asked.
"It says, 'Of course I'll meet you if it's so important, but it had better not be at the house. You know how things have changed. Can we meet at the Star where we used to meet, say 10 o'clock this evening? Yours, Alfred.'"
Charlie Vosper muttered to himself while he assimilated the new information. Then he told the constable to continue the search.
"You'll never believe this," Paul said excitedly, "but I said to Steve this morning that we need a woman in this case."
"I believe you.
Did Kelby have a girlfriend this last few months?" Paul asked the inspector.
"No, not at least since Ronnie came home. Nobody's mentioned a girl except you," Vosper snorted grimly.
"I saw him a few times with a young blonde on his arm at social functions," Paul added.
"Oh, really?" Vosper visibly perked up at this.
"Let's go and ask Inspector Hobden if he knows anything about this."
Walking around to the local police station, they found Hobden in his office.
"We need your help," said Vosper. "After all, you've known these people since they were so high." He beamed encouragingly. "Tell me the gossip on Kelby. Did he have girlfriends?"
Hobden fidgeted uncomfortably.
There was a girlfriend a couple of years back, according to rumour, but she left Melford and went off to college somewhere."
"Was there a scandal?"
"I'm a policeman, Inspector Vosper, not a village barman. How would I know about Kelby's private life? He was discreet about it, and his friends haven't told me about any old scandals before I came."
"Before you came?"
"I've been responsible for this division for 18 months. I came out from Oxford."
They left the police station in disgust.
"What the devil's happening to village life?" snapped Vosper.
Paul telephoned Steve to say he was coming home. Had she eaten?
"No," she said excitedly. "I've been trying to contact you all morning. Did you see the obituaries this morning?"
"Yes, of course."
"Sir Philip Tranmere is dead. Don't you remember? He was the man I told you about who telephoned Lady Delamore yesterday."
Paul remembered.
"He committed suicide last night."
Paul went off and bought another copy of the Times. Tucked away at the foot of the obituary column was a small photograph of a flushed port face with military moustache and baggy eyes. Tranmere's distinguished military career had ended abruptly when he was arrested on suspicion of murdering Lord Delamore at a shooting party in Scotland. Some days later he had been released for lack of evidence, but that had been the end of his career. And now he was dead. The body of Sir Philip Tranmere was in the morgue, but it explained nothing. Sir Philip had jumped out of the window at his club shortly after midnight, 100 feet onto the pavement.
"It's really most irregular, sir,"
the club secretary repeated 3 times.
"We don't expect our members to do things like this here. Last time this happened was in 1892.
"Did Sir Philip seem worried these last few days?" Paul inquired.
"We always took the view that the past was a long time ago," the secretary replied reprovingly. "And Sir Philip was a gentleman. If he were worried, he would not have confided in the barman."
Paul thanked him breezily and went through into the lounge. It was nearly empty, but for a man in a well-cut blue-grey suit standing 3 feet back from the barman, who announced he was closing shortly. Paul took the hint and left. Then he paid an unofficial visit to a friend just down the road in Whitehall.
"I'm not talking to you, Temple."
Paul sat comfortably in a leather armchair and relaxed. Harry had a nice panoramic view of London from his window. He'd got on since the days when he'd been the youngest superintendent in the police force.
"Why ever not?" asked Paul. "You used that information I gave you about the permanent private secretary to the Ministry of Defence. You used it in a novel. I recognised the plot."
"Come off it, Harry. You can't even read."
"I don't need to. I'm telepathic. You're here about Sir Philip Tranmere."
Paul grinned. Harry had been in charge of the investigation into Lord Delamore's death over 20 years ago. Not that Paul had known him in those days. Paul had been commissioned to do a series of newspaper articles on real-life detectives some time previously, and met Harry then. "Now, what's this I've been hearing about a diary? My Inspector Vosper says it's gone missing." Paul nodded. "Someone murdered Alfred Kelby to get hold of it. And Rover Tranmere has committed suicide. Well?" "I wondered what went on at the shooting lodge back when Delamore was killed."
"God knows," said Harry with a laugh. "There was about 15 people staying then, including the secretary and a couple of servants, and they were suffering from what we used to call the 3 A's, affluence, adultery, and alcohol. It was a hot summer, and I suppose they ran out of grouse. From sheer boredom, they probably began shooting each other. They were a shabby, quarrelsome crew. Delamore acted as a kind of ringmaster, organising the revels to create the maximum drama and embarrassment. After a week, somebody shot him. It could have been any one of them, but finding out exactly who made solving Chinese puzzles look easy. They all lied about where they'd been at 2 o'clock that morning or who they'd been with, and half of them were too drunk to remember. Why did you arrest Tranmere? Because I thought he'd done it. He hated Delamore and he was Lady Delamore's lover, but there was no evidence. He couldn't remember whether he'd done it or not. Anyhow, I was relieved to let the whole affair die down. There was more pressing work to do. When Paul reached home at 8 o'clock, he found Scott Reed waiting, and Steve had already scared him with her premonition of death. "Who'd want to kill me?" he asked plaintively. "I'm only a simple publisher." "Who else has read the diary?" Paul asked. "Apart from Kelby, that is."
"Nobody, apart from me, and Bella Spender. I doubt whether Kelby had time to read it because he disappeared half an hour after I left the diary with him."
"Who did the diary say killed Lord Tranmere?"
"Some minor diplomatic type called Price Pemberton. I've never heard of him. But the diary wouldn't be any use as evidence, would it?"
"No," Paul said with a laugh. "But I doubt you'd get Price Pemberton to sign your release. He might even sue you."
He went to the Who's Who on his bookshelf, but Price Pemberton was not entered. He wasn't in the London telephone directory either. Paul telephoned Lady Delamore. It was a difficult conversation because she claimed not to know Price Pemberton, and then, having remembered, affected not to have kept in touch.
"Little Willie was rather tiresome," she shrilled down the telephone. "Always wanted women older than himself. I was very relieved when he dropped out of the diplomatic service and retired to live on the Thames, somewhere near Marlow. But of course he might have drowned in the last 25 years.
Paul agreed and hung up, not feeling very much the wiser. "Scott," he said wearily, "I suppose you'll go through with the business of asking everyone named in the diary to sign a release. Is it worth doing now?"
"I don't know. You might get some interesting reactions."
He paused.
"I suppose you hadn't got round to approaching Sir Philip Tranmere."
Scott leaned forward in his chair. "It's funny you should ask that, because I bumped into him the night before last. I met him at my club, just by chance, and he said he would sign. He didn't seem very interested."
"How funny," Paul murmured. "Perhaps you'd better not approach any of the others."
"I've no idea where to find most of them. A lot of the debutantes and models are probably living abroad, and of course some of them will have died quite naturally. I was going to put an ad in the personal column of the Times, and then there are some policemen." Paul walked thoughtfully to the window and stared across the Thames.
"Speaking of debutantes," he said, "who was that blonde girl who used to be seen with Kelby? She's an attractive young thing."
"Oh, Jenny. She was his girlfriend."
"Jenny, eh? Tell me more. What did she do?"
"She took all her clothes off at a party I gave to launch one of Kelby's books. My wife was appalled, but Kelby didn't seem to notice. She had a beautiful figure."
"What happened to her?"
"I don't know. Perhaps she married a nice young man and settled down. Although I pity the nice young man."
It might have been his imagination, or else Paul had seen a shadow move down in the mews doorway opposite. It looked like a man standing back in the darkest corner.
"My goodness," said Scott, as the sound of the church clock on the other side of Battersea Park came clearly across the water. It was striking 11. "Is that the time? My wife will think I've been killed." It was 10 minutes after 11 when Scott Reed left the house. Paul watched him from the upstairs window.
Scott climbed into his Rover, and while the car door was open, the interior light clearly showed a man sitting in the passenger seat. He appeared to say something, and then the car drove off towards the Albert Bridge. Kate Balfour was not the most efficient housekeeper in the world, yet the Temples kept her on. She tried hard, and some of her cooking was truly excellent, but she often found better things to do with her time than housework, and her treatment of some of Paul's visitors was often deplorable. Only the previous month she'd thrown a guest down the stairs and broken three of his ribs. The police force had never been a very good training ground for domestic service. She followed Scott Reed out of London and onto the Portsmouth Road in Paul's Jaguar. Scott Reed lived in Hambledon, just the other side of Godalming, and if the mystery passenger was going all the way with him, she wouldn't have much to worry about until she got there. She cruised along the Surrey Road at 70 miles an hour, about 25 seconds behind the Rover. Her initial reaction to her assignment had been to curse Scott Reed for not living in Islington like every other publisher. Hambledon, after all, was the best part of a two-hour drive. But once past Surbiton, her stout policewoman's heart was gradually uplifted by the countryside. The silver birches looked elegantly sparse in the full moonlight. The huge cliffs of sandstone that frequently towered on either side of the road were deceptively majestic. From time to time on the deserted road, she glimpsed the Rover ahead. Its taillights blinked whenever Scott Reed braked, and sometimes she saw the car and its two passengers silhouetted on the crest of a hill. Going down the steep slope that was Guildford, she nearly ran into the back of them. They seemed to be chatting, amiably enough. Sometime later, Kate was manoeuvring through the narrow, ancient streets of Godalming, and she felt again the tranquil atmosphere of the early 19th century. That was when she lost the car in front. She increased speed, hoping to reach Scott Reed's house before disaster befell him, and to hell with discreet tailing. She hit 80 through the rural wastes of Whitley, and then slowed down at the top of a hill. The publisher lived somewhere over to the left, if her memory served her well. She glanced at an impressive building on her right, and knew she was on the right road to Scott Reed's stockbroker's Tudor residence. As she pulled up to an imposing gateway beyond Hambledon Common, she noticed Scott and the mystery man were already letting themselves into Scott's house. Kate left the Jaguar on the other side of the green, shinned over a wall with an agility that rendered her 15 stone ridiculous, and crept up to the windows. She saw Scott Reed in his living room pouring drinks from the cupboard for the stranger. It was impossible to hear what they were saying, but they appeared to be on friendly terms. She noted the stranger's appearance, medium build, 5'8", dark hair and swarthy complexion, aged 40 to 50, no distinguishing features. A crook. She walked back to the road where she saw a telephone box and decided to call her employer and keep him abreast of the situation. "That was Kate," said Paul as he tossed his silk dressing gown onto the bed. "She's down in Hambledon." Steve grunted. "The mystery visitor is down there with Scott, drinking and chatting like an old friend."
"Well, there you are," she mumbled.
"I wonder how he means to get back to London."
"Darling, come to bed. Kate can look after herself."
"Poor Kate, I don't really think you like her."
"Nonsense. But I do think it's rather an affectation to employ an ex-policewoman as a domestic help.
Shut up and say something romantic." Kate shuddered as she walked back to the village green. It was cold in the country. A few stray wisps of cloud were streaming across the face of the moon. The stars flickered icily. She thanked God for making her fat, though she called it generous, but then was forced to leap to one side as a maniac bore down on her in a fast car. "Idiot!" she shouted angrily. She memorized the registration number as a conditioned reflex, as it was her police training. 3 seconds later, she spun round and shouted again, "Hey, come back!" It was Mr. Temple's Jaguar, but it was out of sight and on its way back to London. Next morning, Steve was forced to cook breakfast and burn the toast.
"I'm worried about Kate. The car's downstairs in the mews, and we've heard nothing from her."
"Hypocrite," Paul laughed. "You know you don't get on very well."
"But you know the kind of man we're dealing with," Steve said heatedly. "She may even be dead."
"I've already looked in the boot. It was empty."
"Who was the man she described?"
Paul sighed. "It could have been anybody." He bit carefully into the toast and chewed thoroughly. "You know what police descriptions are like. Medium build, dark complexion. Everybody I know fits Kate's descriptions, except for a few women."
This toast is rather well done, isn't it, darling?
Beast, I think you should ring up Scott Reed.
It was nice to see her agitated first thing in the morning. Steve was always tiresomely neat as soon as she woke up. It was a pleasant change to witness her slightly dishevelled. Paul piled on the agony.
What did you do with this coffee? Tastes like you made it with the tea.
Darling, instead of being terribly witty, shouldn't you be finding out what happened to that poor woman?
He telephoned Scott Reed. It might sound a little odd, saying, please can I have my cook back, but Scott had to know something of her whereabouts. And he sounded evasive, which confirmed Paul's feeling that he knew more than he was letting on.
No, I reached home safely, Scott assured him, but it's thoughtful of you to worry.
There was a pause, during which Paul could envisage the publisher changing his mind and worrying and reversing his decisions.
As a matter of fact, I bumped into an old friend when I left you, so nothing could have happened to me. He came all the way back to Hambledon.
Who? Paul asked, trying to sound casual. Was that?
Arthur Grover. He lives in one of the big houses here. Rather a dubious character, actually. We've always assumed he was a bit of a gangster. But last night I was glad about that because Arthur thought we were being followed. I tell you, Paul, I'm rather jumpy.
You were being followed, said Paul. Kate Balfour trailed you down there. And now she's missing.
Kate? Missing? There was a pause.
Arthur wouldn't have. It's only our joke over in the pub about him being a gangster. Perhaps I should have a word with him. Paul Temple spent an hour or so checking on Arthur Grover. It was a name that sounded familiar, and Paul prided himself on knowing most of the gangsters in London and the South East. But somehow it was a name he associated with America. The club circuit, perhaps. But what was that sort of man doing in Surrey?
I fancy a drink before lunch, said Paul. Shall we go down to the corner?
Steve looked aghast.
You've only just had breakfast. Isn't it a little early?
I'll make it a tomato juice.
We have some in the fridge.
The pub on the corner was crowded, but with the best people. No petty criminals, only the big-timers. It was the best place outside Soho to keep in touch with what was happening, and Eric was a useful barman.
Hello, Mr. Temple, he said as they reached the bar. I didn't know you'd got back from the States.
I arrived back on Wednesday. What shall we have, Steve?
A martini for me, she said sweetly.
I'm trying to find out something about a man called Arthur Grover, Paul said when the drinks came.
Arthur?
He runs a casino club in Reigate Street. Runs it with Neville the Knob, you know, Neville Delamore. I thought you met him in New York.
It all clicked into place. Paul could almost see the face. He had met Arthur Grover briefly about 3 years previously. There had been some confusion over their seats at a club, and while the management sorted it out, the two men had done the English thing and had a drink together. Mr. Grover had given the impression that he was a club tycoon over there to study American methods.
What does he look like? Paul asked.
Well, said Eric, medium build, dark complexion. Oh, shut up, Paul laughed. Is he straight? Good Lord, no.
Steve was listening in blank disbelief.
If this man Grover is behind the theft of the diary, then Scott must be implicated as well. But Scott is entirely incapable of deception. He's the sort of person who'd be found out if he forgot to pay his fare on the bus. And why would he harm Kate?
I think we need answers to all those points, said Paul. Eric, can I make a phone call?
Paul looked up the number, then called the casino club. It was difficult to persuade them to put him through to Grover until he mentioned the name of Temple. Then Arthur Grover was on the line instantly.
I wanted to thank you for returning my car this morning, said Paul. I would have been sorry to lose that Jaguar, but I wondered when I could expect my cook to be returned.
Your cook? I don't know what you're talking about, he began. But then he thought of a better argument. I'll see you at Scott's home this afternoon. I want to talk to you anyway.
Paul arrived at Hambledon at 3:30. Arthur Grover turned out to be a sleek, sinister character with a lot of bustling energy and cigar-waving self-confidence. Paul remembered him as soon as he saw him. He was not a man who would be easy to intimidate, but he shook hands with Paul and growled hello. They went into Scott's living room where the publisher was serving tea. It was not a scene into which Soho mobsters fitted easily.
I'm sorry, Paul. Scott Reed began nervously. I should have told you when you telephoned this morning, but I didn't know what to say.
Why? What happened?
Mr. Grover was waiting for me when I left you last night. Paul turned to Arthur Grover. I think you might as well do the talking. Arthur Grover bit into a small sandwich while he considered.
I wanted to know what was going on. I read in the papers about Kelby being dead, and I wanted to know what had happened. You see, I stole the diary from Kelby, but I didn't kill him.
Paul nodded. That made sense.
I always said that Scott Reed ought not to be allowed to mix with the real world. There are too many people like you about, Mr. Grover, and Scott gets himself into trouble.
What do you mean? Scott blustered. Mr. Grover is a neighbor. You don't even know what happened, Paul.
I can guess. I expect you talked to Mr. Grover in the saloon bar one evening over there in the pub on the green, where you both play the game of country squires. You probably told him about this extraordinary diary that you meant to publish.
I may have done.
You wouldn't have known that Neville Delamore was the respectable half of the Grover-Delamore partnership that owns the casino club in Reigate Street, the English half.
Paul Temple smiled at Grover.
Arthur Grover is an American, so he has to have a respectable front man to satisfy the gaming board. He's never boasted to you of his aristocratic friends, Scott.
Grover glowered round his cigar.
Are you threatening me?
Not at all. But you are slightly vulnerable, Mr. Grover. You know how nervous we are in this country of our gambling clubs being controlled by outsiders. I suppose if Neville Delamore needed a diary retrieving to preserve his family name, you could scarcely refuse.
He's a bit of a snob like that, said Grover, and he didn't want his mother to be hurt, but Neville's a good boy. He didn't ask me any favors. I just said I'd get the diary back.
Paul shrugged. Just like that.
Yeah, just like that, Grover said, angrily stubbing out his cigar. I had the manpower. It was no trouble. On Monday morning, a gang of us went out to Melford Cross and picked up Kelby. The intention was to hold him until his secretary handed over the diary, but to our surprise, we found out that wasn't necessary.
Because, Paul prompted, Kelby had the diary on him when he picked him up.
Right, Mr. Temple. Then I telephoned the house and told Ronnie Kelby his father was safe and that he'd find him in the gardener's shed.
Paul then turned to the nervous publisher.
That's it, Paul. That's what Mr. Grover told me last night. He didn't murder anybody.
Of course I didn't murder Kelby. I stole the diary, that's all.
And gave it to Neville Delamore.
Right.
And what about Kate Belfour? What did you do with her?
Arthur Grover sighed irritably.
What would you do if you found someone on your tail? I put the boys onto her. Since then, she's been up at my house waiting for the outcome of our little discussion.
He lit a cigar.
So what is the outcome? I believe you, but I can't believe the police won't charge you with theft, and I can't guarantee that your gambling license will be renewed.
Paul saw the steady figure of Kate Balfour striding across the common towards the house and went to the door to meet her.
But, he called back to Arthur Grover, I'll tell Vosper you play by the rules. He likes that in a crook.
The missing blonde appeared on the Saturday. Kelby was being buried in the churchyard at Melford Cross. It had been discreetly arranged by Tracy Leonard. Just a few close friends, the family, Paul Temple and Detective Inspector Charlie Vosper. Some 35 people filed out of the tiny 14th century church and followed the coffin to the gravesite.
So Lloyd George will have to wait a few more years, a distinguished historian murmured to Paul. There aren't many of us with Kelby's moral courage.
Paul watched the strangely formal ritual of lowering the coffin, inaudible prayers swept away on the April winds, the scattering of the first handfuls of earth onto the box. Kelby's death was wantonly unnecessary, Paul reflected. At least when the Duke of Clarence was drowned in a butt of Malmsey, the English throne was at stake. Tracy Leonard was wiping away a single tear. She looked classical in her grief, tall like Electra and dressed in black. Whereas Ronnie Kelby was flushed and furious, as if he'd thought that his father had let him down again. At the end of the ceremony, he turned swiftly away and strode towards the wrought iron gates. But there was also the blonde, standing separate from the main congregation. It seemed as if everybody else at the funeral knew who she was, Paul sensed, because they pointedly ignored her. She was a source of embarrassment. Leo and Gladys were looking out of place, lurking among the people by the graveside as if they had no right to be there.
servants among the gentry.
When most other people had gone and the gravedigger began filling in the hole, Leo Ashwood remained staring. The blonde in black smiled at Leo as she left, but he stared bleakly through her. He didn't move until the coffin had been completely covered, and then he left without a word. Paul caught up with the blonde and fell into step beside her.
Good morning. We've met before at Scott Reed's New Year party. I'm Paul Temple. I'm sorry we meet again under such unhappy circumstances.
So am I. I remember you. You're the detective novelist.
Yes, I understand you used to live in Melford.
Of course. She turned to him with a radiantly artificial smile. And how nice it is to be back home.
They had reached the gates of the cemetery. Vosper was standing there waiting beside his car.
Hello, Jenny, he said, opening the door. Jenny got into the car without a murmur. The waft of her scent remained in the air to remind Paul that she had been beside him.
Well, Temple, did you find the missing diary?
No, although I did discover who stole it. I'm beginning to think it has no bearing on the case.
I want to know about that diary. In fact, I was summoned to the Assistant Commissioner's office and warned off, told to lay off the official history side. Which, of course, has served to make me even more curious about it. I'll see you in that pub over there at 7.
Vosper climbed into the car beside Jenny and waved to the driver.
Hold on, Charlie. What was the autopsy report on Kelby?
Strangled. Died of a broken neck. There wasn't a drop of water in his lungs.
After Vosper had driven off, Paul wandered over to the hall, where he found Tracy Leonard and Ronnie Kelby in the library.
I know this is not the time to intrude.
That's all right, said Ronnie. Anything will help solve this damn mystery.
Even, Tracy murmured ironically, you, Mr. Temple.
Paul smiled at her irony. All I've managed to find out is that Mr. Kelby made an assignment with a woman at 10 o'clock on the day of his murder, and we've no idea whether he kept it.
What woman was this? Ronnie asked in astonishment.
I don't know.
Tracy Leonard had turned sickly pale.
Do you know who it might have been, Miss Leonard?
Why should I know? I'm only his secretary. Mr. Kelby's personal assignments would be his private affair.
And where were you at 10 o'clock that evening, Ronnie? Paul asked.
Me? That was the time Tracy and I decided we weren't going to find my father and went to the police station.
Paul nodded encouragingly. Was that before or after the phone call?
Phone call?
He was startled, and he glanced in alarm towards Tracy.
What phone call?
Didn't someone telephone on Monday evening?
No, nobody telephoned.
Tracy shook her head in confirmation.
We were together all evening.
Gladys Ashwood then entered the room with a tray of tea and buttered crumpets and began serving.
How did you find America? Paul asked Ronnie, changing the subject. Did you make a fortune?
No, the Carnegies and the Fords got there ahead of me. I'm broke, Mr. Temple. My father was trying to find me a job before he was strangled.
You knew that? Paul asked, taking another crumpet.
That he died of a broken neck? Yes, the inspector told me yesterday.
He only told me this afternoon, but then you are next of kin.
Look, Temple, I don't know what you're getting at, but my father is dead.
Before Paul could make soothing noises, the young man had turned away in distress, and Tracy Leonard was being all maternal.
Then Gladys Ashwood started weeping.
This is hardly fair, Mr. Temple, Tracy Leonard said coldly. Ronnie was only just on the point of making things up with his father when Mr. Kelby died. That leaves a lot of guilt that needs careful handling, which you are singularly failing to do. And look what you've done to poor Gladys.
Gladys was stumbling towards the door, mumbling,
It isn't so. It isn't true.
Her crying could be heard all the way down the passage and into the kitchen, and Tracy followed her out.
Paul felt slightly awkward, and a few moments later went to see what he could do, finding Tracy outside the kitchen door.
Is Gladys all right?
She nodded.
Look, the trouble with murder investigations is that all the humdrum secrets we usually live with are singled out for examination. Even the nicest man, by the time his idiosyncrasies have been given the once-over, can appear an alcoholic or egomaniac, a womanizer or a skinflint. I'd like you to know how much I admired Alfred Kelby.
Her large brown eyes were sad as she smiled.
I didn't admire him, Mr. Temple.
I was in love with him. Yet at the same time, I despised him. There are no humdrum secrets, as you call them, between a man and his secretary. Was he in love with you? No. I think he might have loved me once during the summer I first came here. But then he lost interest, found someone else. I've meant nothing to Alfred these last 4 years.
He must have been mad, Paul murmured. She grinned.
Thanks.
By the way, Paul added, almost as an afterthought, who was the blonde girl at the funeral today?
That was Jenny Mortimer.
Jenny Mortimer?
Yes. Ted Mortimer's daughter.